Pleasure of introducing our speaker for this evening, Beth from Tarzana. Please join me in giving her a warm welcome.
Hi, I'm Beth.
Hi, Beth.
From Woodland Hills, but that's fine. it's right on the board, it doesn't matter, I could care less. Hi. I want to thank the committee for inviting me tonight. It is quite an honor and it is quite humbling, and I am grateful and overwhelmed and nervous and full of love. I'm very familiar with this convention. I've been of different levels of service in this convention over the years, and as a matter of fact, I've been in program for almost 19 years. It'll be 19 years in May. And in my first year in program, they needed help apparently doing decorations for the luncheon tables. I was not a year in program. I had never been to a convention. And my friend Anna, who was a past chair, she wasn't the chair that year, she took me to the committee planning meeting, and Melce was the chair that year. And she said, I have this person here, Beth, I told her she's going to do the luncheon table decorations. And Melce said, in front of me, I'm standing there, true story, she can't do luncheon table decorations. She's not even a year in program. She doesn't know, she's never been. And Anna said, and I quote, she's not here tonight, she's out of town, I love her. She said, oh, don't worry, she's not going anywhere, she's too messed up. They didn't tell me there were 3,940 tables, 47 tables that I had to decorate for something like a budget of $26. But a lot of people showed up to help me, and I learned about fellowship, you know. I came to Al-Anon, like I said, 18 and a half years ago, terrified, afraid, freaked out, certain my marriage was over. We had been coincidentally married about 19 years. And together, 22 or something like that before I came. Oh, may we grab my water? Do you mind? Thank you. And my first meeting was at a Tuesday night in a lodge in Woodland Hills, and I cried the whole time. And I remember that no one spoke to me. That's how I remember it. That might not be true. And I was just a wreck of a human. And I do remember very clearly that I walked out of that meeting and I looked up to this night sky and said to the stars out loud, I do remember this. I do not want to be here. I just want him to stop drinking. I went to a Thursday night Tarzana meeting after that, and the people in that meeting loved me and carried me and worried about me and helped me. My husband was still drinking. He was really angry I was going to a cult. And I was terrified he was going to murder me, and then he was going to divorce me, and the divorce was worse for me. And the people in Thursday night Tarzana meeting helped me walk back home at the end of the meeting when I was so afraid. One woman, I remember, she held my face like this, and she said, where are your feet? And I said, they're down there. My feet are beneath me. And she said, just walk forward. And when you go home, before you walk into the house, see all the faces of the people in the meeting going in your house with you. And at that meeting, there were a couple of dear friends who were also newcomers who are here with me tonight. And one of them was really funny and in a lot of pain like I was. Our husbands were both still drinking. And she went to the podium. We were just gutted. And she said, I'm so angry at my husband tonight. I asked her if I could share this story because he came to my yoga class with me and he was grunting and groaning in the class. Doesn't everybody know you're supposed to be quiet in a yoga class? He's an alcoholic. And I thought, through my tears, I started to laugh a little bit because my husband is the exact same way. I thought we were terminally unique, you know. And I just want to share this little thing. Jim is his name. He won't care that I share this. He has a little injury in his leg right now. And when he's doing physical therapy in our bedroom, you guys, you would think his appendix are being taken out without anesthesia. And it reminds me of Wendy and Mike. That husband has did a skit for me in this Al-Anon convention one year, and I love them dearly. And I followed Wendy to Monday night fellowship and to Monday night meeting. It was so big and overwhelming. And that's where I found my fellowship and my home group and my sponsor. And what was told to me by the women, mostly, at Monday night was this. I read them, I reported to them just how bad my alcoholic marriage was. I was sure that no one in Al-Anon had ever had a marriage that bad. And they said something like, "Shh, breathe. We hear your story. We got it. You don't need to finish. Can you stretch your imagination? Can you stretch your imagination to maybe shift your perspective, to maybe consider that part of your unhappiness is your own doing? And can you maybe consider shifting your perspective ever so slightly to just think about that your husband might have a disease that he doesn't feel in control of right now, and you don't have power? Just think about it. Just consider it." Consider for a second that since you're so powerless, there might be a power bigger than you and bigger than Jim that can take care of this. Just think about it. And I liked that, and I'll tell you why. Because they asked me, Beth, to shift my imagination. And I like stories. I like the arts, I like literature, I like history, I like arts and smarts is what I call them. And I could grab onto that. And my feeling was, okay, I surrender, I get that, just show me. And they said, okay, we heard your story, heard plenty of your story, now we want you to sit down and listen to these stories. And so here's my story for you tonight. I was born in Detroit. I have an older and younger brother. My mom was this big. She was darling and very powerful and very funny. And she was a social worker for children at Children's Hospital of Detroit. It's a big, dramatic job. My dad was tall and quiet and an automotive news writer and a little bit checked out, not really emotionally available. Not mean, loving, and loyal. My mom's history is this, and it is relevant. She grew up in New York. Her dad was a gambler and a crook. And they were always in and out of poverty. My grandma had to get a bookkeeping job to hide money from him. My mom lied about her age when she was 14 to go sweep factory floors at night. And a miracle happened. My grandma went to an open house at high school, and one English teacher said to my grandma, "Where is Lucille going after high school?" And my grandma said, "She's going to secretarial school." And this one English teacher said, no. Lucille needs to go to college. And that's where my mom found her escape, in the arts and smarts. She loved learning and she loved history and she was, you know, graduated. She met my dad, and that was her escape route from a very traumatic childhood. And she was a social worker, so she gave good advice. You know, she's one of those people who took their trauma and took it into mental health. The unfortunate thing about their marriage and their situation and where she thought she escaped to is that both my older and younger brother had diagnosable mental illness. My older brother was bipolar and narcissistic and very rageful, and my younger brother had schizoaffective disorder. So when I was about 9, my younger brother started acting strange, and my mother in the late 60s took him to psychiatry, which she later, when she evolved as a therapist, felt super guilty about. And then when my older brother hit, he was a teenager, so I was like now 10 or 12, he started raging, crazy raging in the car and stuff like that. When's it going to stop? And she couldn't get my dad, for lack of a better expression, forgive me, to sort of man up. I think my dad's on the spectrum. That's for another program. I don't know. But he didn't know. And it was really ugly for a long time. I also remember when my younger brother was born and I was 5, the nurse, you know, in the 60s, they would send a nurse home with your mom from the hospital for a little bit. She wouldn't let me go see my mom in the bedroom. And I remember very clearly standing in that hallway and feeling so alone and afraid and lonely. And for a long, long time, alone and lonely was confused for me. Because I was a little girl in this house just sort of teeter-tottering between which crisis was being put out. But they never really bothered me with it. I mean, the other thing I do want to say about that house is it was beautiful. We were not rich. We were upwardly mobile, and my mom liked art galleries, and it was decorated very well. But if you opened a pantry in my house, my childhood house, it was such expired food and cereal on the shelves. Cookies were never rewrapped, so they would stay fresh. it was so paradoxical when I think about it, in the refrigerator would be like takeout cartons with a crust. And my dad, you would ask him for a certain kind of soda from the market, or, you know, and he couldn't come home with the right stuff. So there was this presentation, but what I call the guts or the machinery of running the family inside were very chaotic, not unlike alcoholism. But, you know, my mom and I were very close, and she was quite charming, as I said, and we knew, even if it wasn't said out loud, we sort of escaped the genetic trauma, tragedy of mental illness. So we went out in the world, not telling anyone what was going on, and sort of killed it. I mean, book clubs, trying out for plays, a lot of girlfriends, student council. In high school, I did the morning announcements. You know, I was like, just crap didn't stink for me. And I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of friends. And I went on that way in college. A lot of fun, a lot of friends, never really knew what was going on. The other thing about my family where I grew up that I want to share is we weren't a tribe, even though there were three kids. Dinners were really fast. I don't know what they were. My mom didn't really cook. I never really learned homemaking skills. I learned that from friends in high schools visiting their houses and from girlfriends in college roommates. But we weren't like... We didn't sit at the dinner table and say, like, did you ever resolve that thing that with that teacher that pissed you off last week? Or, oh, what time is your show? Or, are we going to Adam's tennis match? There was never that a community or a tribe. It was all divide and conquer in my family growing up. So I go to college. I have a lot of fun. Have a great boyfriend, doing the deal, showing off, doing my thing. I also felt like I became an analyst by osmosis, because I was the daughter of a therapist, so aren't I a therapist too? And, you know, you could come to me anyways. I would tell you what to do, what your major would be. I was thinking about it. You know how they say in AA, like, alcoholism is, drinking is fun, then fun with problems, then just problems? For me, my Al-Anonism is advice with anger, and then just anger. I made that up. That's not from the literature. After I graduated with an English major and whatever, doing plays and stuff, I didn't know what to do. A lot of my childhood was like that. I would just I was a good kid. I didn't cause them any problems. I would rather babysit in high school than party. I love children. I'm mad about them. I get them. And I didn't know what to do, so I said, okay, I'm just going to go to Chicago and audition for professional training programs, like to be an actress maybe or something like that. I don't know. I got into a program in California. I just want to share one really quick story. I was sharing this part of it as a Zoom meeting in COVID, and the secretary interrupted me during my 10-minute share and said, Beth, we don't share our professions from the podium. And I thought to myself, breathe. I don't think I shared my profession from the podium. And my second thought was in my head, Madam Secretary, keep coming back. That's my truth. So I come to California promising my parents I would never stay. Never. I would go to the East Coast. I was just doing this thing. Blind. I did that, you know, before I got there too, I just went to be an au pair with some strange family in England. Like, no cell phones. My parents were like, yeah, whatever you need to do, go do. We got to go do this thing over here with these guys. I'm come to California. First day, west of Chicago in my whole life. I'm unloading my stuff in the graduate housing, and a young man is riding his bicycle up and down the driveway, and he says to me, you're coming to my party tonight. Okay. I'm in the apartment upstairs. My name is Jim. You're coming to my party tonight. And we have not been apart for 43 years. That's my husband. In September, we will be married 40 years. And I can't tell this story without telling the other part. True. I am a liar. I didn't say that up front. But this part isn't a lie. Let's just skip that. When I went to camp when I was a little girl, I was 14. I just got to tell this lie because you got to know the lie. My parents were that summer in Mackinac Island, which is a little island between the Lower Peninsula and the Upper. And the Grand Hotel there looks like the White House, but three times as big. And they sent me a postcard from there. And I told my bunk mates, you guys, that was my house. And I didn't say... A minute later, JK, just kidding. I saw their faces and I was like, I'm going to live like this all summer. They're buying it. I thought, you know, I'm like, who was I spending the summer thinking I was Paris Hilton? Like, it was crazy. Anyway, at that party in graduate school, three people, this is not a lie, I can tell you their names, two of them were guys, admittedly, came up to me and warned me about him. And one of them said something like this. You seem like a really nice girl from the Midwest and all that. You should stay away from him. Mm-hmm. Well, he never looked better. I mean, sure, that just was great. And we had a big, fun, fabulous romance, as all beginning alcoholic romances are. One of my college roommates from there told me, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, she said, you know, Beth, the whole campus reverberated with your love affair, and I love that. Jim looked very different than the men I was used to, my brothers and my dad. He was organized. He was centered. We had similar family values, even though we were from different religions. His light shone on me. My light shone on him. I calmed him down. He lifted me up. It was so much fun. However, speaking of lying, we got a return there because that's the truth. I fell out of love with what I went to do there in no less than 2 weeks. I had a great time like doing plays in high school and in college and was full of myself. And when I saw what that life meant for me, that's not how I was raised. I was raised that you work at something you're going to be rewarded at, and you work steadily and hard, and you don't do a risky thing, and I hated it. So think of this. I mean, I'm glad I stayed. I wanted the degree. I didn't know where it would lead. It did turn me on to my profession I have today. But I was lying for 2 full years of graduate school, going to classes and workshops and convincing teachers that I wanted to do this thing that I really didn't like for a gym, for the romance. I wasn't going to leave. There was no way I was going to leave. But in thinking about speaking to you tonight, I thought to myself, that had to be a lot of work. That had to be, like, exhausting. And maybe it was. But I knew for sure that once we graduated, the nightly drinking and partying was going to stop, because everyone knows that. And I wouldn't be here tonight if it stopped. That much I also know. And when we graduated, Jim worked a couple of months a year for a couple of years in a row in Santa Fe. And unbelievably, you guys, the guest room that he was assigned to stay in of a woman in Santa Fe, she was in Al-Anon. Her husband died an alcoholic death. He, from diabetes, he had an amputation. She had 5 sons. Most of them were alcoholic. She was a retired mail carrier who was feisty and weathered and fabulous and artsy. And she was on to me. She saw exactly what was going, and we became very close. And she told me about Al-Anon. Her name was Margaret. She's my first angel. And I didn't go for 17 years. And I didn't go for 17 years because, you know, we were upwardly mobile. And my story is that when you have upward mobility, you don't rock the boat. Same message I got in my childhood home as my mom went out in the world and they were managing all of this mental illness, and there was a lot. Don't tell anybody, because whatever is working out there will stop and will crash and burn. So I thought no one would love me, no one would like us, we wouldn't have the reward we were having, and I better just deal with it at home, which was hard and sad. When our older daughter was born, I thought for sure the drinking was going to stop. Because it says in the marriage contract, when you have a child, you don't drink from Sunday to Friday. Saturday nights you can have a drink and maybe two, but it is in the marriage contract, I think. I could be wrong. I came home from the hospital. Anna was born a few days early. It was a pretty scary emergency cesarean situation. And I woke up the next day. She was in bed with me, and Jim wasn't in bed. And I went in the nursery, and he was asleep on the floor with an empty six-pack next to him. And I thought, whoa, you're in trouble now, my friend. The nursery did get finished being painted, which was, of course, the thing. He could do all the things. I just had to cope with this other thing that was so painful, and the feelings of abandonment were overwhelming. And we went on like that for a lot of years. When my kids were little kids, my older raging PhD psychologist brother got arrested for a sex crime. And there was a trial. And I went home. I went home from this life that I was kept from my brother's craziness. My parents loved me and adored me and did the best that they could. They were not self-involved, cruel people. And to go to that trial, my mother, who had worked so hard to sort of escape her childhood and then manage this trauma, my dad's brother was schizophrenic and her dad was, so it was coming genetically, you know. She was smashed into smithereens because when something's in the newspaper and on the news, there's no amount of energy in the world and skill set to hide it. And it was awful. I was always worried about my older brother. He was a little boy who lived since two. He wore really thick glasses and he was a very talented musician. The raging started, but I always intuitively knew he was going to have a hard time on the planet. I can't explain it. And I was pre-Al-Anon, and my mom was upset with me that I didn't emotionally carry her during that. And I wasn't affectionate enough with her. And I wasn't this, and I didn't. And she was looking for me to fill what we know is the God-sized hole in her heart. And Margaret told me, you know, I wasn't an Al-Anon. You know, that's not your job. That's not your job. Life went on. We went to a therapist. Didn't know much about alcoholism. We only went for a few times, and when I told her the story of my brothers, instead of looking at the alcoholic and straightening him out, she said, where were you in this family of these brothers? And I said, I don't know what you're asking me. I was having this great childhood. I was babysitter and I played. And she said, no, where were you in this house? And I didn't answer it. It was never answered, and it stayed unresolved for me until I got into the Al-Anon program. And what happened was, for us, the gift was, I guess you could say in hindsight, that the upward mobility, my husband, I had my own business, my husband had a really big job that paid a lot of money, and that was coming to an end. So on top of alcoholism became depression and ginormous financial fear and raging and this, all this stuff. And for me, what was happening, as my friends in this room know, is Ursula the Sea Witch was born. I imagine myself like, when my daughters, you know, everything that was messy in my house, you know how, like when I went to camp, you're supposed to put your kids' names in little writing and labels. My mom would write my name on my tushy of my underwear, like in Sharpie, you know. And so I was like the crazy extreme of, I drew on my kids' lunchboxes and put notes in until they were 18, hand to God. And everything, the list and everything, and God forbid a soccer coach would not play my kid enough. That was not a pretty sight. So Ursa the Sea Witch is blah, and Anna started to get ready for college programs at 16 and thinking about that. And I said to myself, oh, yeah, Beth, your daughters are either going to marry an alcoholic or become alcoholics because of this situation going on here, so you need to get help. And so I did. I went to Al-Anon. I went to that Monday meeting. And I felt carried and I felt terrified. That was in May. In August of that year, my husband was still drinking, and it was my birthday. We were going to a sushi bar with the girls, 16 and 13, and he was drunk. And for the first time, you know, my family, we had done successfully what my first family couldn't do. We did Christmases and Hanukkahs beautifully and decorated the house and stayed up all night like his family talking about politics and religion. And so to break that was to break the thing, to not go to my birthday that I had promised I would never do to my kids, you know what I mean? And I called my sponsor. I'm going to tell you about that in a second. And I said, her husband answered the phone. Jack, may he rest in peace. He said, what's going on? And I said, oh, Jack, it's my birthday and my husband's drunk. And he said, I'm so sorry, sweetheart. Hold on for Mary. And Mary said, you got to go to a meeting. The bravest thing I think I've ever done in Al-Anon is walk away from my daughter's 16 and 13-year-old faces when I left that house that night. That is my true feeling. And I called. We didn't have phone, we didn't have it on our phones and on our computers in 2006. So I guess Jen G was the mayor of meetings in San Fernando Valley that year. Mary said, call Jen G. And I called Jen. She said, go to Burbank. I just didn't want to. They wouldn't know me. My anonymity would be broken. And I went to that Burbank meeting, and I sat in a big social hall in the far corner table, and I cried. And right before that meeting started, in walked another young sponsee of Mary's. She lives in Europe now. Her name's Boriana. And she said, Beth, what's going on? And I said, it's my birthday and my husband's drunk. And she said, I'm going to lead the Alateen meeting. Stay right here, and I'll take you out for tea afterwards. I need to tell you, I cried for 3 months in that first meeting before I had my sponsor. And one night, that format, the Monday night format, once a month has an ask it basket, and someone shared that they were afraid, and they were this, and they were that. And, you know, Beth, the big talker, the big performer, raised her hand. 3 months in, no sponsor. And I answered that question, and I said, it sounds like you're very lonely. I understand. Keep coming back. And then a few shares later, a long-timer answered a question, and my mind went like, you know, when a long-timer shares, when you're a newcomer, you're like, oh, I'll never forget what she said. I got to write that down. I don't know what she said. I have no idea what she said. And somehow I feel better. I'll never be able to remember it. And after the meeting, she came up to me and she said, I like your share. And I said, will you be my sponsor? And she said, call me tomorrow at 6 a.m. and I'll tell you what you need to do. And I called her and she said, you need to call me for 30 days. You need to show up at Monday night so I can look you square in the eyes, make sure you're not batty, cuckoo crazy. And you need to come to my book study weekend this weekend. And I said, oh, God, no. My husband's going to murder me and then divorce me again. And I can't live like I can't. Oh, wait. We're being taken to the Hollywood Bowl on Friday night. And I said, I'm so sorry. I can't come. Thank you for inviting me anyway. And she said, uh-uh. She talked to the other woman she shared the book study with, and she said, we decided you could drive up Saturday night. Now, remember, my husband's upset because his big job is coming to an end. And I go up to the book study, and there were the weirdest women in that room who I love so much today, and they had me sleep on a stinky plaid sofa. And in the morning meeting, we went around and said our names, and I was sitting on a hearth next to another woman, and she said her name, and it was my husband's business partner. The woman, I'd only met her once, I didn't remember what she looked like, who had been in charge of my husband's big 10-year job. And I felt like my mom did at the trial in my head. Like a crazy thought. Oh, the world's over. We're never going to be hired again. We're never going to be loved again. He's going to murder me, and then he's going to divorce me, and all the things. Divorce was. And I went up to Lisa at the break, and I said, oh, Lisa, oh, my God, you're not going to believe this. You are not going to believe this. That's my husband's business partner. She's here. It's all over. And she said to me, you better go say hi. That's all she said. And I learned about anonymity and safety in the Al-Anon family groups. In October of that year, Jim decided to stop drinking. He went to two meetings. Thank you to Tony, Lois's husband. May he rest in peace. And he came home and he said, Beth, those people are nuts. And I said, thought to myself, because you're not, because I'm not, and I didn't say a word. I was instructed for a year not to say a word. And he has not had a drink in 18 and a half years. He loves Al-Anon, and he will refer people to AA. And all that means is that his restless, irritable, and discontent is big. He doesn't have someone he's responsible to. And that can be tricky for me. That's a hard personality to live with. A week after he decided to stop drinking, he was responsible to take 20 college students to a trip to Wyoming that the university had blessed, sanctioned, and it was going to be a great creative trip. And he actually said to the kids, before he had a chaperone, another buddy with him, Nobody dies on this trip. And one car of five kids had to leave a night early for another project, and they wanted to leave after they all went bowling at 10 at night, and Jim said, no, you need to leave at 7 when the sun is up, and, my hand to God, no one lets the driver be the only one awake. Someone has to stay awake with the driver. And they all fell asleep in the middle of Wyoming, no drinking involved. And the car went careening off the road, tumbling and tumbling, James Bond style. And one young man, who Jim is still very close to, went running to a community hospital for help, and one young man who was not wearing his seatbelt died. And I got that call at night, and I thought, one more time, my life is over. This is unfathomable that this could happen, and he hasn't been drinking for a week. And I called that business partner, and she asked me again to shift my perspective. And she said, do you realize how lucky you are that he wasn't drinking? I said, oh, yeah. Because if he had been drinking, and Jim drank to go to sleep, drank to pass out, he would then do shenanigans and never remember it the next day. But I said, oh, yeah, you're right. And then I called my sponsor, who said the most amazing thing. She said to me, I don't know if she remembers, she said to me, Beth, a terrible tragedy happened to a family. A terrible, terrible tragedy happened to a family. It did not happen to you. You are one step closer to the center of that circle. And there's Jim, and there's you. And your responsibility is to breathe, and to have compassion, and to be of service. Can you do that? I said, yes, I can do that. And I live by that to this day. That helps me with the drama. Even that happens maybe to my daughters. It did not happen to me. And I need to be of service until they work it out. And he's never had, as far as I know, a drink to that day. And that young man called his mom. His mom shared at the memorial that morning. She had so much grace and dignity. And she said he had called her that day and said, Mom, this is the greatest trip of my life. I am having so much fun. And the university has a fundraiser for him every year. I started to do my steps, and I learned that I have character defects, born of character assets, of bravado and confidence and all that sort of stuff. I was prideful, sure, absolutely. I was self-righteous, 100%. I was greedy. What? I'm a Leo, don't you know? I am not greedy. I am generous, and I'll give anybody anything. And she said, no. You are greedy because you are taking from other people to fill yourself up instead of doing the repair work yourself. And you are demanding that, it wasn't said quite that mean. And you are asking for other people to change themselves and pulling from them in ways that is not your business and is not your power. And I said, oh, okay, I got it. Wow, that's a new shift of thinking. That's a shift of perspective. And in my first meeting with my sponsor, we talked about a higher power. I was raised in a humanistic tradition. I'm very proud of that. We learned a lot about philosophy and arts and smarts and the whole deal. And she said, imagine, besides Margaret, your higher power is a stream of goodness that is ever encircling the earth. And it's always been there. This comes from our literature, by the way. And it will always be there. And you have a choice during the day, whether you are snarky to someone on the road, or whether you are compassionate with people, or take a breath and don't answer back when whatever happens to you, tone of voice, the whole thing, to be part of a stream of goodness or not. And I really like that. My faith in my higher power has expanded from that. I am not one of those people that has, even raised in humanist tradition, struggle with my faith. Because I think I came so willing and desperate, and I said, just show me, and I was shown. And I really sort of never looked back. I like the Einstein idea of miracles, that there are two ways to live your life. The first is as though nothing is a miracle, and the second is as though everything is a miracle. I like it because it's mysterious, and I don't need to know that particular answer. My blessing comes from living a life with love and humility, not out of entitlement. And that was a shift for me. I listened to a speaker. I think he spoke here in my first or second convention, Father Tom. And he talks about listening to a friend of his named Sister Catherine, who talks about not so much God as I understand as God as I experience. And I really like that. That's what I mean when I say I see miracles in my rearview mirror instead of, even when coincidences happen and people I love say, is that odd or is that God? It doesn't matter. I think something happens, someone I owe amends to, I'll never think I see again, shows up somewhere. I am relaxed and centered and hopefully put my ego down so I don't get nervous and panicked. I think, here's your moment. That's amazing. What do I do with those moments is me walking with a higher power, you know. I started to make my amends. And my first writing of my amends was, you know, obvious how I could make amends to my kids and to my husband. And to my mom, I wrote that I owed her amends because she said to me I broke her heart for moving and staying in California. And I owed her an amends for that. And Mary said, no, try again. Let's go put pen to paper again. No, she said, you get to come to California and meet your person and have your big life. That is not how you owe your mom an amends. So let's try this. After I did my writing again, she said, when the God moment comes, and it will present itself if you're quiet, thank your mom for all she did for you. And she did a lot. She did a lot. She was fabulous. And I did. Thanked her for a lot of different things, and she thought it was really weird, and that's fine. God as I experience. God as Beth experiences dancing. I love to dance. I love babies. I think they're miracles. And I love toddlers, and toddlers love me. I love trees. I think that the roots are like our story, and our branches and how we splay out is our journey. I like Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, which I listen to a lot today. I go to retreats, which I hardly recommend. My fellowship beyond my Monday meeting blooms, and we laugh a ton. We do crazy stuff like skits, and we share pain, and we cry, and we learn, and we grow. At one of these retreats, I heard this incredible story from Bonnie R., and she said this from the podium. She said, when we first start Al-Anon, it's like we're living in a tiny shed, and the tools of the shed are just falling apart. There's an old rusty saw hanging over here, and a lawnmower with a chain falling off, and a hammer with the handle is splintered. And as we keep coming back to Al-Anon, and this is my experience, the shed starts to grow, and it starts to grow a little more. It starts to grow a little more. And pretty soon there's slats in the wood panels, and there's a breeze coming through. Grows a little more. And through the beams of the ceiling, you can see the night sky and sun and sunrise and birds, and it continues to grow, and grass grows. Friends can come in. Friends can go out. Eventually, this tool shed is the size of a football field, and way over there is that old rusty saw. And over there is the lawnmower with the chain falling off, and over there is the saw, the hammer with the rusty thing. I like seeing those tools. I like waving to them. I acknowledge them. They are certainly part of my story and my tool shed, and it's just fine. I'm not worried about it. I rarely pick them up. My tools in the shed today look like a flower and a friend. A flower and an Al-Anon friend is pretty much my tools today. We talk about our voice. You know, I hear newcomers come, and we say, shh, it's me, I got it, it's a big story, I understand it, I get it. Just listen for a little while, put your tushy in the chair and listen for a little while, and my voice, then I'll feel like a doormat. And to this day, 18 and a half years, I need my sponsor to help me build my voice, and we work on that. You know, 4 years into program, I worked so hard, and he had a little raging fit, and she said, why don't you say something? I said, what do you mean? I get to say something? And she said, yeah, why don't you try saying, I love you, I see you're having a hard time, I'm going to go now. I hope you work it out. Not with a patronizing overtone. And I had a real, I'm not, my voice is not something, besides performative crap, is not something that's organic when I have a big feeling in here and I have to reason it out with my buddies or with my sponsor. And I'm going to share an honest thing that happened recently. My husband has a big voice. He's an amazing human being, by the way. He's a great guy. He gets cranky and irritable, and it feels really hard for me. And I was telling my sponsor about it, and I did say, I was honest, we were in the car, and I couldn't really handle it, and I said, I waited, I said, I don't think it's good for you, like, raging all the time. I just don't think it's great. I didn't have an expectation, and I told her about it, and she said, this is 18 and a half years into program. She said, why don't you try saying I'm scared? I don't think she would have said that 4 years in, but you can ask her. Next time it happened, because, you know, those of you who are in marriages like mine, it's going to happen once in a while. And I not only said, this was, I don't know, 3 weeks ago, I said I'm scared, and I started to blubber and cry boogers. Like, the whole heaving, sobbing, I couldn't settle myself down. I had no expectation that that would happen. And what I said, besides I'm scared, which I didn't plan and just came out, was, I do not want to feel like I felt in my house with my older brother anymore. I do not want to feel that way anymore. I couldn't have planned it. That was also walking with a higher power for me, because I'll tell you what, I don't have an expectation, even remotely, that that's going to help my husband, his whatever. He's a great guy. But he heard. He heard in a loving, gentle, I am so sorry way, and he got it, you know? Boundaries. Boundaries are another one I wanted to share about that come up with people in program. I am never going to bring him coffee again the morning after he's drunk and pees on the computer in the morning. Never. He's never going to, I'm never going to, and I set a boundary. I think, well, it's in the literature. The thing I love about the Al-Anon program is the fluidity and flexibility in our language. The creativity behind the original writing is so impressive to me. And boundaries, as our current world can express them, set an unrealistic expectation for Al-Anon people. It's just one day at a time. It's just one day at a time, and it's ever-changing. The stream of goodness is ever in flow. And so, one more time, I heard from my sponsor this year. She said, let's think of boundaries like this. Boundaries are the distance I put between me and you so that I can love you the best way that I can. Boundaries are the distance I put between me and you so that I can love you the best way that I can. That's not just with my family. Sometimes that's with cuckoo crazy Al-Anon people. I mean, let's be honest. With my daughters. Sometimes I feel more close with one daughter than another. Sometimes one marriage is like a little out of control and I have to just separate myself. The distance I put between me and you so that I can love you the best way that I can. How am I doing on time? I have 20 minutes?
No.
Okay. Who knows what I think? I'm not going to dance. I'll end early. It's not going to happen. I want to talk about sponsorship a little bit. I think of my sponsees. I'm telling you, I like stories. I like imagery. I like all that stuff as rainbows. Some of them know that, but I don't know. You're here tonight. Little rainbows. Each little rainbow. And I feel like each one has hues of a different color. And they're just out of whack, you know. And I feel like it's my responsibility to help them find where they're comfortable in their rainbow. And to me, that means helping their character defects get back to a character asset. You know what I mean? One other thing I want to share about, I had a sponsee ask me recently in regard to the fires, and I hope everybody is feeling okay and being of service to the next person to the center of the circle, as we are known to do. And this has to do with feelings and parenting. I feel grateful that I used to volunteer with my mom, as I said, in Children's Hospital, and I do have a character asset with children combined with Al-Anon, and I think every family is different. Sure, we all have the same affect of alcoholism, but I like to listen to where every family might be a little different. And anyway, regarding the fires and all of our big feelings about the fires, a sponsee asked me, she said, I want to check in with my kids. We had, you know, our family was in the path of the fire. Their houses didn't burn miraculously, but they were staying at our house, and it was a lot, and I'm feeling a lot. I love her so much. And I want to check in with their feelings about it, which is such a genuinely loving Al-Anon thing to think we should do for our kids. And I made a suggestion. I only give a few options. Let's talk about a few options. Let's write about it and talk a few options. And I said, why don't you guys go out for ice cream? And why don't you tell them what your experience was? Why don't you tell them, boy, that was scary. School closed and all that stuff. They're little biddies. And why don't you say, and then so-and-so were staying at our house. And that was a lot for me. How's your ice cream? How you doing? How's your ice cream? I did that as a mommy. I would want to dissect my kids in my effort to protect them. At the same time, I've also had people say, I just detach, you know, my situation is rough and I detach, and the alcoholic is acting crazy like my husband. And I'll say, they're children. Why don't you, when you detach, walk them out of the room with you? There's a notion, you know. In Al-Anon, this is another Father Tom-ism, I'll be honest. In Al-Anon, we think of things as black or white. He's in trouble, or he's doing great. He's not drinking, he's going to be really happy. They're wrong, they acted bad, they acted good. I'm okay, I'm not okay. I'm killing it, I'm not killing it, in such extremes. Because in alcoholism and in Al-Anonism, that is how the family looks. I mean, the stories, when someone comes up and says, I have a pressing problem, and they tell you what the pressing problem is, you're like, it just gets so big in alcoholism. And Father Tom says, if you live that way, you know, between black and white is not gray. Between black and white is all the other colors, the blues and the reds and the purples and the pinks and the yellows. And between the black and white are all the tastes and the flavors. And if we stay in the black and white, us Al-Anons, we're not going to see all those other things. But we sometimes come and are like that, because then we don't have to think too much. And that was certainly my experience. So I'm going to end with this. I'm trying to think if there's anything I left out. this is not... Oh. My brother. Thank you, Lisa. I was at a heart-to-heart retreat, and it was the last meeting of the day, of the weekend. And I turned my phone on, going to pack my stuff to put in my car. And I had a message from a Detroit detective. And I looked up, and the only person sitting at a picnic table was one of my Al-Anon sisters, and another woman with the same sponsor. And I said, oh, Shawnee, I don't think I should listen to this message by myself. It was a message that my younger, sweet brother, Adam, had dropped dead in his apartment. And in 30 seconds, I had 80 or 800 Al-Anon and alcoholic women standing around me. He worked in a library. He was passionate about it. He didn't have a TV. His medicine made him quite large, and he lived in this tiny little house for apartment for disability. And books were even stacked in his closet, and his clothes were in a basket on the floor. And his memorial looked like this. I'm sitting in the front row. My mom had died, dropped dead a few years earlier. My dad was living with us with dementia at the time, and I was caregiving for him. And I asked the librarian where he worked to share, and she said, Adam knew everyone's name who visited the library. He knew where their kids went to school, and he knew what book they like, and he was beloved. Now, I thought of Adam as a man-child and a weirdo. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't even get glasses. You know, he read with someone who read nonstop, read with a magnifying glass. And she said, as a matter of fact, we've closed the library today. For the first time, we've closed the Farmington Hills Library. So would you all turn around? And I turned around, and there were hundreds of people there to come and honor my brother, and I knew nothing of that, of his life. And what's sad for me is he was the memory of my family, that all that I pushed and compartmentalized so I could go and have my big life, he would remember. My older brother, when he got out of jail, I was in Al-Anon by then, and his narcissism exists, and he came when I was moving my father back and threatened me, and I had to call police. My sponsor and I had all the ducks in a row. If he shows up and it gets scary, just call the police. And I called the police, and they came, and he was there. And I dealt with it with such maturity. And so he didn't come to my father's memorial, and I don't know if I'll ever see him again. But I will tell you the serenity prayer. Oh, this is another higher power thing. I walked to the end of my driveway as I experienced my higher power. Every morning, like my parents did my whole life, and I get the morning newspaper, and I have a chat in the sunrise with my folks and my brother. That's where I experience higher power. I don't know if I'll see that brother again, and it's a little bit scary, but I'll be okay. And I miss Adam a lot. I do, you know, I've lost one of my Al-Anon best friends who did a couple of skits with me, who worked on convention chair, Kathleen, my sponsor's husband, my best buddy in programs, husband died of alcoholism, and I was the first there before even all her kids were there, with my other best buddy in program, and we could be of service to the center of the circle. Thank you, Lisa. I love you all so much. So I'm going to leave you with this. Take what you like and leave the rest. It's just suggestions of what worked for me. Bunk with a roommate, bunk with a stranger at a retreat. You may find yourself sitting under a tree and writing steps together. Learn something. Decorate a convention table if they ask you to decorate a convention table. Show up to your meetings in person, preferably, because that's where your fellowship will bloom. Have faith that your higher power is resting in your heart. And pray to be the best person that you can be in this 5 minutes on the earth, because that is what I try to do. I don't know why Beth's heart and brain and this body and this soul and this spirit were given 5 minutes on the planet. That's my responsibility, to walk with love and kindness. That's how I engage with my higher power. And, you know, drop your boat in the stream of goodness. We're waiting for you. Morph into a mermaid. Put on some flippers. I don't know. We are waiting for you in the stream of goodness. I walk beside the people who, the angels, who have led the way before me, and beside a higher power who loves me. Thank you for letting me share. Aww.